Letters on Sympathy by Sophia de Grouchy, first published in 1798. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Letter 3, Individual Sympathy. Today, my dear friend, I want to speak to you about individual sympathy, the one that establishes between men the intimate bonds necessary for their perfection and happiness, and draws hearts together and entwines them with the most tender affections. Being based on connections that are more direct than the ones general sympathy is based on, it more readily pertains to all men. And if it were cultivated more, it could produce in the mass of men who have become almost insensitive to everything but their own survival and their own happiness, a concern for the ills and needs of all humanity. The fact is that all the parts of our sensibility are interconnected. As soon as one is exercised, the others become more refined and more likely to be stimulated. The first manifestations of this sympathy arise at the moment when things that can arouse it come into our view. When we see someone for the first time, we look at his features, seeking his soul in his face. If it is graceful or beautiful, or even merely unusual in some way, we scrutinize it closely, trying to take in its features, and to sort out those that are most permanent in it. There is no one whose looks do not immediately give us some idea of his character, or at least give us an opinion, favourable or not, about his mind. Impressions based on facial features are soon strengthened, changed, or erased by impressions based on how the person moves, on his mannerisms, on his speech, and by how well or badly his conduct squares with what he says. When we believe we can find, in the look through which the soul seeks to come through, in the speech that unfolds its movements, in the features that reveal habits, and in the mannerisms that betray them, the signs of qualities that especially interest us, because they are connected with our own, or because we admire them or find them striking and unusual, we feel a surge of goodwill towards the person who appears to be endowed with these qualities. We feel drawn towards him, take pleasure in attending to him, and experience an interest in him that leads us to observations of him and makes them more penetrating. Sometimes, however, this first impression is strong enough to confuse us, swamps us so that we lose our ability to observe. For those endowed with a lively soul, the effect of this first impression is the basic source of the preconceptions that blind them, and that make them incapable of distinguishing reliably, and sometimes even of judging reasonably. This individual sympathy, so long regarded as inexplicable, is actually just a very natural effect of our moral sensibility. When someone offers promise of qualities that we like, we feel drawn towards him, because, by awakening in us the idea of these qualities, he leads us to expect all the advantages we tacitly associate with their reality. That's how it is that our most elementary and unthinking self-love leads inevitably to our liking people whose opinions concur with ours, enhancing the value we attach to our own judgments, and reassuring us against the fear of being wrong. And that's how it is that we are interested in people who are praiseworthy for their virtues, their humaneness, their benevolence, whether because our memory of them is a resource for our own planning and projects, or because the mere idea of the good they have done, and can do, gives us a strong impression of the kind ordinarily caused by the reality or the promise of some public happiness, or by the relief of some particular misfortune. You may think, my dear friend, that the effect is disproportionate to the cause, and you will surely ask me why individual sympathy is sometimes so strong when its sources are so weak and vague. Why? The answer is that our first impressions have an admixture of enthusiasm, fanaticism, which extends them beyond the point where our knowledge of the facts would take them. If you consider this moral phenomenon, you will see how large a part it plays in our strong, at first sight, individual sympathies, and how perfectly it explains them. Enthusiasm comes from our soul's ability to represent to itself, all at once, but rather vaguely, all the pleasures and all the pains that may result for us from a certain state of affairs, or from the existence of a particular person, and of our relationship to him or her. This representation takes material that would actually require months, years, sometimes even a lifetime to unfold, and condenses it into a single instant. Thus enthusiasm sees its subject with one kind of exaggeration, and this representation is always vague in some respects, because it takes in too much for the mind to see its parts clearly. And this generates another kind of exaggeration in the realm of feeling, because of the proliferation of pains and pleasures we imagine. It even generates real error, getting us agitated by fears of things and desires for things that can't possibly arrive, or that can't possibly all arrive, this impossibility being hidden from us by the agitation of our soul. Habit has an odd influence on this disposition. If some event or individual stirs it up in us several times, habit retains the power to stimulate it again without our even thinking about it. And in that case, we can classify enthusiasm as an emotion of the soul. The fear of being dishonoured, for example, is so active only because we conjure up, vividly and all at once, all the miseries of a life in disgrace. But once this has happened, the mere idea of dishonour can arouse this feeling, without calling up any of the other ideas that first gave rise to it. And in the same way, our enthusiasm for certain qualities disposes us to an immediate and unreflective sympathy toward people in whom we think we see them. So our proneness to experience these strong immediate sympathies depends, as does enthusiasm, on firstly the strength of the imagination that takes in vast panoramas of sensations and events, on secondly the strength of the sensibility that is more or less strongly affected by these imaginings, and retains them more or less constantly, and perhaps also on thirdly some more or less deep reflections that we have made on the object of these sympathies. If a sort of instinct or some particular circumstances have made us reflect on a situation, an opinion, or a personal quality, then our ideas, having spread themselves over its advantages or drawbacks, have in a way prepared within our hearts an affection for individuals who are in that situation, who have that opinion, or that personal quality. And the need to find an object for that affection, to let loose an emotion we have long carried in our soul, without being aware of it, produces in us these sudden sympathies that often seem like products of chance or whim. I speak of the need to find an object, but it may be the pleasure of actually finding one. So the nature and the duration of individual sympathies depend on the strength of the imagination, on the strength of the sensibility, and on how far we go in thinking about the sympathy's causes. These sympathies come about more readily and seem more intense in folk who see with their imagination, feel according to first impressions, and have more agitation of ideas than warmth of feeling. They occur even more often between people with a highly developed moral sense, and they are gentle in proportion to how delicate and pure the other person is. That is because nature, to strengthen our links with one another, has willed that virtue's affections be nearly as sweet as its deeds. They are longer lasting between those whose sensibility is more deep than lively, more gentle and delicate than passionate, and between those who love with the truth and purity of heart that are as necessary for the affections' attractiveness as for their durability. They are more intimate between melancholic and reflective souls, who enjoy feeding on their own feelings, savouring them in memory. Souls who, seeing in life only what binds them to it, remain focused on their affections, with no power to want anything beyond them. Because if the human heart stops right there, it never reaches the bottom of the well of true happiness, however insatiable it is. It has often been said that esteem was the strongest basis for individual sympathies. But not enough has been said about the appeal of this feeling itself. In previous accounts, the human heart has not been made delicate enough. Esteem is essential for the first levels of well-being that our soul is capable of, namely, trust and freedom. Only with esteem can we love with the full force of sensibility. It is, in a way, the single medium where our affections develop, where the heart has free rein, and where, as a result, it fully develops. In honest souls, esteem is always a silent companion of individual sympathies. It can even shape these sympathies by focusing on some special personal qualities. It is itself a pleasure when it does that. A man who is worthy of esteem is happy to esteem others. His heart, easily moved by the mere thought of a good deed, is tied and attached to anyone he thinks capable of performing one. He is glad to be with him, and this brotherhood of virtue establishes between them a freedom and an equality, the feeling of which may be as tender as that of the closest blood and natural ties. If the first stirrings of sympathy, elicited by the looks and mannerisms of someone we hardly know, and by a few words of conversation with him, are enough to make his presence a pleasure, and if mere esteem creates in us a feeling of goodwill and freedom, the basic positive feeling that disposes us to have all the others, that shows how sweet can be a more deeply rooted and more felt sympathy, and what the pleasure of friendship can be. This pleasure can be said to begin before friendship has begun, as soon as we can see that the friendship is going to come. In fact, as soon as we can have the idea of someone who might befriend us, merely someone capable of deep and delicate affections, we have a delightful feeling, because we assemble in our soul an idea of all the sweetness that friendship can bring us. This feeling is already a joy, and that is why, even while we regard ourselves as beings who are capable of feeling physical pain and pleasure, the pleasure of loving and being loved is, all on its own, happiness for us. The pleasure of loving also comes in part from our enjoyment of the idea, the recollection or hope of our affections bringing happiness to another sensitive being. If we are regularly in the company of this person, if his rapport with us is strengthened by individual sympathy, if enthusiasm vividly represents to us all the happiness our friendship can bring him, and the happiness we can expect from it, then our pleasure in caring for him increases. And as soon as this pleasure has been repeated enough for our sensibility to feel its attraction and develop a need for it, the person in question becomes dearer to us, and the feeling he inspires in us becomes a necessary part of our existence. The pleasure we get from loving, at least in the case of friendship, is largely due to our pleasure in making other people happy through our affections. This is so true that only generous souls can love. Souls that lack magnanimity or nobility or have been corrupted by selfishness may well want to be loved and seek the delight and fruits of love. But the only ones who know how to love are generous hearts that can be touched by the happiness of others. All the sources of individual sympathy, agreement in opinions, tastes, and moral characters can bring two people together and unite their hearts on the surface. But solid, true, durable affections that are independent of place, time, and self-interest, and are suitable for enchanting life or softening it, have to be based on the lovely capacity to get joy from the happiness of others. When we lead children to practice and carefully cultivate in their souls their natural sensitivity to the joys of others, and especially to the pleasure of contributing to such joys, we not only dispose them towards the most tender and useful virtues, but also are assured that they will be capable of love, that they will feel all its charm, or at least that they will be worthy of it. The sight of beauty inspires a pleasurable feeling. Whatever the true origin of the beautiful is, all I mean here by beauty is what we enjoy seeing. A beautiful person is, to all eyes, a being endowed with the power to add to the happiness of anyone who has any connection with him. We are led to attach greater value to his words, his mannerisms, his sentiments, and his actions, because they are more charming. So we are naturally drawn to him. This feeling of attraction, combined with the feeling that can be produced in us by physical traits and qualities of soul, gives rise to a particular feeling that we call love. It differs from other feelings, mainly because it gives us a pleasant sensation that always recurs at the sight or even the idea of the person whom we love. This power to make us happy at every moment, to carry away, to occupy, to bind, and to fill our entire sensibility, has more command over people than all the joys of friendship, than the appeal of engaging with virtuous men. One can hardly doubt that beauty, or at least something agreeable and interesting in the person's physical appearance, is necessary for love. Exceptions to this are fairly rare among men, the taste for pleasure being nearly always the cause. If there are more exceptions among women, that is because, from their infancy, they have had instilled in them moral values of modesty and duty that have led them to be wary of first impressions, not to make decisions based on physical appearance, and to attach more weight to certain qualities, always, and to a certain moral rectitude, sometimes. Love can have many different causes, and the more causes it has, the greater it is. Sometimes a single charm, a single quality, touches and captures our sensibility. Often, too often, our sensibility falls for gifts extraneous to the heart. When it becomes more fine-tuned and enlightened, it is drawn only by what can give it satisfaction, and, steering by an instinct as sure as the instinct of reason and prudence, it yields only to love, which takes in all that is worthy of love. Then love becomes a true passion, even in the purest souls, even in creatures who are the least enslaved by the impressions and needs of the senses. Then innocent caresses can long suffice, and lose nothing of their charm and their value after they have been given. Then the happiness of being loved is the most needed and desired rapture. Then all ideas of happiness and physical pleasure arise from a single object, always depend on it, and are wiped out with regard to anyone else. But for love to be love, a perfect mutual understanding must allow two souls to unite without reservations, to love with boundless trust, and to value everything that they love. It has to be the case that the person who is drawn to our form and good looks is also drawn to everything about us, our imperfections, as well as our attractive personal qualities, that he would restore and guide our happiness in our failures as well as our successes, at times when we need to be consoled for what we have undergone and learned about the human condition, as well as times when we can hardly bear life, and above all that the happy blend of characters, minds and hearts of two individuals will allow their happiness to check the natural inconstancy and rash desires of the human heart. How far individual sympathy is reciprocated depends on what its causes are. It is sure to be reciprocated when it is based on conformity of tastes, opinions, and above all, ways of feeling. But it is often reciprocated without this conformity. In those cases, it springs from our being naturally drawn to those who love us. And it is just as strong, even when the inducements that bring two people together are different. So loving is a reason for being loved, unless special factors have distorted our sensibility in such a way that sympathy cannot be returned. Thus, in everyday language, the meaning of sympathy includes the idea of reciprocity. This reciprocity is harder to find in the passion of love, because the primary driver of love, even the purest kind of love, is an attraction that is mostly independent of the moral qualities that condition sympathy and other feelings. A sweet face pleases, affects, and inspires love, but what distinguishes this love from friendship is precisely the ever-renewed pleasure we feel in seeing or remembering that face. Thus, for love to be reciprocated, its causes must be at least, to some extent, reciprocated. The causes of this reciprocity may be common in nature, but they are scattered thinly, and one can sense how rare it must be for them to coincide, or at least how difficult for them to be absolutely the same or equally strong in two beings brought together by them. Let us now explore what degree of sympathy is needed for us to be attracted by, and get pleasure from, the company of people we see often. It seems to me, my dear friend, that the sympathy based on esteem is not sufficient for that, because what is ordinarily meant by esteem is only the calm interest we have in ordinary goodness, or the one that austere virtues or brilliant mental qualities inspire in us, and an interest of this kind, unaided, has only a quite weak charm, unless, as rarely happens, it is raised to the highest degree. Besides, any quality or perfection must be accompanied by indulgence, gentleness, goodness, if it is not to disturb our independence or weigh on our weakness. The human heart's first need is freedom. For it to be just and happy, it must be free to attach itself to what it admires. And it is no doubt a misfortune that the virtues we most admire are often those that give us the least hope of indulgence. A man of sensibility, therefore, can love only the qualities of mind that come with virtues. He can love only the virtues that are feelings rather than opinions, ones that indulgence makes likeable and affecting, ones that seek to be imitated only by making themselves felt, ones that we cannot see in others without feeling them stir in us, even before we act on them. The sympathy needed for friendship does not always demand likeable qualities. The tender virtues that must come into a relationship of the less intimate kind, if it is to have any charm. Often, the particular knowledge we have of some merit that is very rare in itself, or capable of stirring our sensibility, attracts us, gradually binds us, and makes us forget the imperfections that come with it. That being what often unites folk whose characters and tastes are very dissimilar. This seeming oddity often takes place between more buttoned-up souls, who open themselves up only to things that captivate them. These souls reserve themselves so completely for their effective life that their affections are sweeter and more valuable, and can be reciprocated without help from any other feelings. These souls are the most capable of constancy and passion. But their feelings won't endure unless there is a very broad and intimate sympathy. When love becomes powerful enough to count as passion, it is a series of desires, needs, and hopes that ceaselessly clamour for satisfaction. They are still pleasures for the soul that they disturb, because this very disturbance becomes an habitual emotional state that always has happiness mixed in with it. The harmony of hearts and minds, the union of tastes and opinions, and the sweetness of feeling everything together, as though feeling everything for each other. This alone, in the bosom of shared happiness, can satisfy love's demands, and support its enchantments that so often cut short its duration. Pleasures of the mind, of the skills and of virtue, savoured in the bosom of the heart's pleasures, deepen and intensify the latter. Given the present state of civilization, they are even necessary for the continuation of those pleasures, adding to them a myriad of different charms. They purify them, enrich them, and renew them, extending them across all the stages of life. Up to here, my dear friend, I have shown you how physical sympathy that becomes individual, strengthened by various circumstances and made more active and energetic by enthusiasm, can, unaided, give rise in us to moral pains and pleasures. But this sympathy with another human being has an origin independent of the nature of his pains or pleasures. We suffer in seeing him suffer. The idea of his pains is a pain for us too. So it is clear that what I have said about physical pains is also true of moral pains, from the moment we are first able to experience them. Seeing or remembering someone else's moral pains affects us in the same way as does seeing or remembering his physical pains. Here, then, are new bonds of sympathy that unite us with others and broaden our connections to them. Not only are the sight or memory of others' moral or physical pains or pleasures accompanied by pain and pleasure in us, but also, as I have explained, once this sensibility is awakened and activated in our souls, it is reactivated purely by the abstract idea of well-being or suffering. This gives us an internal and personal incentive to do good and to avoid doing harm. This incentive follows from our natures as feeling and thinking beings, and in delicate souls it can be a monitor for the conscience and an engine for virtue. End of letter 3.